Far outside the Earth's gravity well, a whole new economy is waiting to flourish. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. One of the biggest barriers to ambitious projects in Earth orbit and beyond is the cost of launch. The rocket equation is unforgiving. Each kilogram of equipment, of water, or of crew lofted into orbit requires a great deal of propellant to get it there, and all that propellant needs more propellant to lift it in turn. It's costly and difficult to launch the necessities for large, long-duration missions. An alternative, though, is to reduce the mass to be launched by obtaining some of those supplies in space. Deep Space Industries is one of a small number of companies currently developing plans to develop natural resources in space. Their focus is asteroids as a source for propellants, metals, and more. It's a technical challenge, but also an organizational and economic one. As hard as it is to find and develop a new ore body on Earth, there's a proven model for how to do so, and a whole economy and a suite of techniques and technologies to support that. In space, all of these things have yet to be established. Daniel Faber is one of the founders and now the CEO of Deep Space Industries. I spoke to him at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in The Woodlands, Texas, about how his company plans to develop a capability and a business for mining asteroids.
So, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And you're working now with a company called Deep Space Industries.
That's correct.
Could you give me a bit of an introduction to what they are doing?
Yeah, Deep Space Industries has the vision of extracting mineral resources from asteroids, processing them, turning them into things that people want to buy. So we are starting off with a bunch of exploration missions, doing surveys and the like to improve the geological understanding of the asteroids, to build our capabilities. We're also doing a lot of work on the business side to prove out the markets, and of course on the processing side, there's a lot of technologies that we need to have so that when we have the material, we're ready to go.
So are there particular resources that you're after? What are you hoping to extract from asteroids?
Yeah, definitely. We've looked at what's going to be the early markets, what are going to be the later markets. And we see the earlier markets are for defraying the launch costs. Launch costs are quite expensive. Mm-hmm. And one of the largest and I guess the simplest things to consider is fuel and rocket V, rocket fuel, delta V capability. So looking to provide that for existing spacecraft to extend their life. And in the future to enable spacecraft to launch without fuel and then be refueled when they get there.
Okay, so to save all the weight of carrying fuel into orbit, you'll provide it on orbit.
That's right. And yeah. And current consumption is tens of tons per year, and it's enough of a market to get us started and to bootstrap. Longer term, we're seeing at the moment a lot of activity happening in commercial space, including the tourist activities, and a lot of innovative things that people are planning. If even a fraction of those come to fruition, we'll see a vastly expanding demand, and hopefully we can meet that then with the materials that we have available and facilitate that. So again, long-term vision perspective, we hope to see an expanding commercial market in space. Okay. And a lot of activities that currently don't exist.
But asteroids, they're not made of rocket fuel.
Asteroids have a high volatile content. Okay. Depending on which asteroids you choose, they can have 20% or more water content.
20% water?
Yep.
Okay. And water makes for fuel?
So water can be used as fuel. You can split it into hydrogen and oxygen, which of course is fuel. It's readily ionized for electric propulsion. Yeah. There are a number of things that you can do with that.
Okay.
There's other volatiles as well. It's not just water. That's just the easiest one to name and easiest one for people to conceptualize.
Right. Okay. So this is the early market, you said, is propellant. But what comes further?
So immediately on the heels of that, already we're developing a 3D printing technology. So there's also a large content of nickel and iron in asteroids. And even the stony asteroids tend to have native iron granules in them with a high nickel content. So we have a process that can extract that nickel without the need for a lot of wet chemistry or those kind of things, and directly 3D print them into useful structures. So with that, we can print solar concentrated rocket nozzles, truss and structural members, those kind of things. So we see that as the immediate subsequent market.
Mm-hmm. Making metal structures.
That's exactly
right. Okay. And nickel is particularly useful for that?
Nickel is the easiest. It's the most amenable to the process that we've patented and that we're developing. We can also use the same process for iron with certain modifications. There's a lot of different options for how that can be used.
Okay. And those are they, again, the market is on orbit? You would supply that to things that are in space?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything that's useful to sell to the surface of the Earth?
There is.
Yeah.
For us, we see that as byproducts.
Okay.
That's not something that we hang the company off. But absolutely, we think there are a number of things that once we've gone through and extracted some of the value from the materials that we can use on orbit, there'll be bright products that we can then bring to the Earth.
So on the Earth, where we're already recovering mineral resources and making things and selling them, there's a whole process of looking for places to find resources and recognizing their commercializability and then developing them into sources and mines and things. Is there a similar process in space, or how is that going to work?
Well, at the moment there isn't a process in space, but that's one of the things that we're looking to introduce. So you're absolutely right on the mineral exploration side. There is a multi-step process. There are markets built around that. People know how to manage the risks, the geological risk, the technical risk, everything that's involved in that to bring a discovery and a geological understanding through to a recognition of an ore body and full delineation of that ore body up to developing the mine. And it goes beyond that as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just enough to have a mine. You have to be able to process that material. You have to be able to extract that material into, extract the usable parts from that. And then even further beyond the what people traditionally think of as the mining industry, you have to be able to take that material and turn it into useful products.
Right.
So most definitely there's a long sequence of things that need to be done. So the process flow, if you like, for exploration, is fairly well defined on Earth, and we can copy a lot of that. The process flow for the extraction and milling and refining, again, we can copy a lot of that from Earth. The differences, of course, when we're looking for asteroids, completely different kind of geology, different understanding, so we need to make sure that we have that. The different on the processing side with low gravities, vacuum, those kind of environments, we need to be able to handle that.
Right.
So we're looking at a lot of the terrestrial technologies and how we need to modify them.
Okay. And the first step, I guess, is finding asteroids.
Of course.
Are they all the same? Are they all useful to you? How do you recognize the good ones?
I mean, there are lots of different classes and subclasses of asteroids, and we know about a lot of asteroids. We know about hundreds of thousands of asteroids now. We know about quite a few that are in orbits that are close to the Earth, which are more interesting. They're easier to reach in terms of the amount of propellant that you need to go out and get them. So that's the sort of starting point is the public databases, and looking to improve on those in certain ways, doing effectively remote sensing,
okay,
which is the step that you would start in a terrestrial process, identifying what you're looking for in the publicly available remote sensing data, and the geological understandings that we have. So that's the first step. There's lots of them out there.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on what material you're after, you'd be looking at for different classes of asteroids based on different spectral response.
Yeah, of course.
But it's also worth commenting that there's a lot that we don't know. There really is. The composition of the asteroids, just in the last few years, we've realized that it was thought that asteroids below a certain size were monolithic, we get to observe any monolithic asteroids. Everything keeps coming down as a rubble pile.
Oh, so it's not one big piece of rock.
That's right.
Yeah.
But we're not sure. We haven't observed very many. We have very few data points, especially at the small side. We have absolutely no data points at all. Mm-hmm. I think Itokawa may be the smallest asteroid that's actually been photographed, and that's now been visited. And it was a rubble pile, and nobody was sure whether that would be a rubble pile or a monolith.
Right.
So once you get below that, below the few hundred meters across, is there a transition point where they become monoliths? This is one of the very important questions to answer. You can imagine if you arrive there to mine it, or even if you arrive to explore and you find that it's not what you expected, then you could show up with the wrong instruments, you could not be able to take a sample, you might not be able to mine anything at all. Huge implications for that. So we need to answer that question. Similarly with the compositions, what we're finding more and more is that the asteroids are not they're not homogeneous. They're very inhomogeneous. They tend to be a collection of different types of asteroids. So we classify the asteroids based on the meteorites that we have, and the meteorites, we can divide them into the categories, the metallic asteroids, the carbonaceous chondrites, the stonies, the achondrites, many different subsets. But there was a very interesting fall that happened just last year, I think it was. They tracked an asteroid, they discovered it and tracked it just a few hours before it impacted the Earth.
Okay.
And then were able to go out and collect that. So the size was estimated just to be just a few meters across, and yet they found seven different types of meteorites within that same fall when they went out to collect it.
Seven completely different kinds of
That's right.
material.
So you can't say that we're going to see a homogeneous body when we get there. And now, is that the norm or is that the anomaly? We have one data point. That doesn't make a statistic.
Yeah.
We have an existence proof. That's all that we have. So right. there's a lot of information that we need to gather.
And so does that make it very challenging to recover resources? If
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely it does. And that's why we have a long-term program. That's
okay.
why we say the vision is that we'll be extracting resources and turning them into things that people want. Okay. Along the way, there's a lot of other things that we'll be doing.
A lot of characterization, I expect.
Absolutely.
So you start with remote sensing. What's the next step?
Once we have some targets that we think are prospective, we need to go out there and visit them. So Deep Space Industries has defined a series of missions, starting with flyby missions, progressing to rendezvous missions, and then bulk sample return, where we bring back enough of the sample to put it through a trial process.
Right.
So we will then crush it, grind it, do whatever we need to do, run it through our 3D printer, whatever happens to be the process flow for that particular target, we will test that out. To satisfy ourselves that we could do that. So, yeah, there's a series there. Those are the sort of broad brush strokes on how we go through that.
Okay. And are those experiments you're going to run on Earth, on the ground? Or
we'll be running a lot of the experiments on Earth.
Yeah.
I definitely will be proving everything out as best we can on Earth. We'll be using simulant materials. We'll be using terrestrial analogs. We'll be using even meteorite material. But ultimately, if we intend to be processing on orbit, we need to actually do the tests on orbit because that's a different environment.
Right.
And so there's no way that we can avoid doing those tests on orbit.
Okay. So of all the bodies and all the places in the solar system, what makes the asteroids the interesting place to get resources from?
They're outside of a gravity well.
Okay.
Everything else you have to lift.
Right.
Everything else you have to worry about getting it off the Earth, off the surface of a body. The asteroids, you don't. They're there in free space. They can be taken and used with a lot less hassle.
And so, you don't have to spend propellant to make your propellant. So who are your first customers? Is it to sell to space agencies, or who do you imagine being able to sell this stuff to early on?
So if we look at the rocket fuel,
yeah.
the Delta V capability, that's of interest to commercial satellite providers.
Mm-hmm.
There may also be a market for water at space stations or anything like that using very similar things. So that could be government as well. At the end of the day, it will become a commodity market. How much Delta V would you need? How much fuel would you like? So we'll sell to anyone who has an interest.
Anybody who wants it.
Sure.
Great. And the market for metals on orbit, how much farther into the future does it take before you get that? How much infrastructure do you need on orbit before that becomes a market that you can chase?
Well, that's to be determined.
Yeah.
And there's a go-to-market strategy behind that, but at the end of the day, that's one of the things that we need to work up to.
Okay. And you're in the remote sensing stage now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you expect to have flight of these kind of flyby missions in the relatively near term? Or how?
Yeah, we're looking at getting those going in just a few years.
Okay. So as you plan that sequence of steps of missions, flybys, and sample return, and so on, what technologies do you still have to develop?
A lot of the technologies are being developed for small spacecraft. We want to use very small spacecraft because we can do that cost effectively. Mm-hmm. So key technologies, of course, communications, propulsion, radiation tolerance. Of course, we need power, especially if we have electric propulsion. Some of these exist. Some of these, everything can always, of course, be optimized. So we keep pushing the boundaries on everything that's available.
But that sounds like it's just the ordinary technologies of making spacecraft, just smaller and more cost-effective.
That's absolutely correct. For these early survey missions, the biggest driver is to get the cost down, get the size down.
Okay. So where are your next steps then? Where do you see yourself going in the next couple of years, your company rather? Where do you see your company going in the next couple of years?
Yeah, so we have this first spacecraft going up in a couple of years' time, in about 18 months.
Okay.
And that'll be a lot of technology development capability building.
Okay.
Shortly after that, we'll be doing our asteroid missions and to get those underway. In the meantime, a lot of development happening on the processing side, and these things happen in parallel. So those are the main pushes at the moment.
Okay. And at this sort of early stage, how big is the company? How many people does it take to do this early stage of work?
Yeah, at the moment we've been doing a lot of the business development work. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're still a fairly young company,
right.
So all of that's come together really well,
okay.
And we've started to expand now. So we have, I think, 25 people on the team.
Okay,
and then a lot of advisors as well. So it's a growing company.
So if we've got young engineers out there looking for a place to work, are you going to be hiring those kind of people, or who's your labor needs in this?
Yeah, we're interested in people who have built from the mission side, from mm-hmm. the spacecraft side, interested in people who have built small, cheap spacecraft
mm-hmm.
and know their way around that, know the implications on developing things small. You mentioned before when you asked what are the new technologies, and you almost discounted the cost innovation.
Mm-hmm.
To us, cost innovation is absolutely vital.
Right.
And it's very hard to get people to appreciate how important that is and how hard that is.
Right.
So we want people who understand what cost innovation is about and how to do it for a small spacecraft.
How to do things at low cost and small size formats.
That's right.
Right. Yep.
So that's one of our big pushes is the cost innovation.
Okay.
So so we're looking for people who have that experience, people, of course, who have deep space experience, guidance, navigation, control, all of the things that you might imagine go into those kind of spacecraft. On the processing side, we're looking for talented process engineers, chemists, physicists, people who can work with that. We also need people who have experience doing on-orbit testing. A lot of testing and verification and that kind of work, but wrapping a flight payload around a geochemical experiment,
right.
A process experiment. We also need a lot of people to work the business plan and the business side of the company, and that can't be underestimated either. On all of the companies, the technology companies and product and service companies, you have to run that company efficiently.
Of course.
And make sure all of that happens.
Okay. Well, good luck with running it efficiently and with running it and with these goals that you have. And
thanks.
I hope to see some results in the coming years.
Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks for talking to us.
No worries.
You're listening to Western Worlds. Let's go to the discussion.
It's an ambitious project, this idea. We might go mine asteroids. And everybody jumps to the idea of rocks. That's what we're going to take. We're going to take nickel, we're going to take iron, we're going to take rocky stuff. But Daniel starts by talking about water. And that's a particularly useful thing on orbit. That's hard to get.
Yeah, but I still find it just so bizarre to go mine things. I mean, I've heard, mining, I guess, Mars and Moon for, using the resources while you are there.
Mm-hmm.
But just mining a rock, which is literally lying between, I guess, mm-hmm. Mars and Jupiter, and just like, hey, that is iron, let's go mine iron. Like,
yeah.
you know, I guess we are losing a lot of resources here on Earth, but still, I think we are still far away from going picking rocks in the solar system.
I don't know. I think it's not a crazy idea. I think it's a good idea.
Crazy by technology means right now.
I think only in terms of the time it would take. If you're talking about the time it takes to get there and get back, then. As a concept, though, no, this is a good idea. Why is it a good idea? Because there's loads of rocks in the solar system. There's loads of this stuff. It's just, it's all over the place. And you can do, when you're there, you could do your mining, but you can also do archaeological stuff, find out about the history of the solar system, and find out, because a lot of the footprint of this, anybody who's into meteorites will tell you, is in these rocks. A lot of the footprint of the age of the solar system, the formation of the solar system is in there. So you can kill two birds with one stone, plus you can then mine some very abundant materials. I mean, these asteroids were created during the formation of the solar system in the accretion disk. Therefore, there will be, hopefully, a lot of very interesting materials in there that may be also very rare on Earth.
Yeah, in fact, rare Earth elements are among the things that are thought to be...
And the rare Earth elements are rare, not because they're rare on Earth, but because they're rare, like, scientifically, of course. However, there could be still millions of tons of palladium just sitting out there waiting for people to grab it. So,
and the other thing I think to remember is that, you know, the business models for these asteroid mining initiatives, by and large, they don't rely on the terrestrial market. We're not going to replace mining iron on Earth, because there's a lot of iron on Earth.
Yeah.
We're not going to replace terrestrial mining with sky mining. We're not going to go and pull it out of asteroids and deliver it to Earth, because that probably will never be cheaper than picking up iron off the surface of the Earth, which is full of it. But iron, or water for that matter, are very heavy to lift into orbit. So you could find some rocks that aren't sitting in a deep gravity well. So the on-orbit use of the propellants and maybe later the metals, he talks about 3D printing nickel components for spacecraft. I think that's a much more believable market than necessarily sending it to Earth.
Yeah, when you think of it in that sense, you've got material that's already out of the gravitational well, as Daniel said, and so you're going to be saving a lot of transport costs by getting material in situ. In a sense, it's the sustainable way to go.
I have heard ideas of mining the near-Earth asteroids just because, hey, they're close.
Yeah.
And if there's one coming close that you know, I guess, I don't know, 10, 20 years ahead of time.
That you can go up to that.
Yeah, go up and just go grab it. I've heard those ideas.
Yep.
I have heard grabbing asteroids, bringing them close to Earth, closer to Earth than they are, and then basically mine them, and I guess process them on ISS. I've heard this idea before, where you process all the ores, because it's easier to process them in space than it's here on Earth. So just process them there and then transport them back to Earth. So
maybe, yeah. The transport down to Earth, you know, it depends if the market's there for that. But imagine, like, look at the Saturn V rocket that we used to go to the moon, right? There's a little tiny capsule on top and this enormous rocket,
yeah,
right, made out of metal and full of hydrogen and oxygen. And most of that metal and most of that hydrogen and oxygen is just there to lift the rest of the rocket. The spacecraft only makes up some few single-digit percent of the total mass of that thing. So if you can, and that's in part because they have to send it all the way to the moon, right? So if you can just boost the Apollo capsule into orbit and then hook it up to a rocket that you built on orbit out of metal and oxygen and hydrogen that you pulled out of asteroids or something, that saves you a huge amount of mass. And you go into Tsiolkovsky's equation, and every little bit of extra kilograms that you add is a whole exponential extra fuel that you have to put onto it, and that means a bigger fuel tank and so on. It's a runaway thing. So every kilogram you can save makes the mission a lot easier.
I think if you allowed yourself to think a little bit further into the future, then you could imagine a kind of ecosystem of mining operations feeding orbital operations, where you would have vehicles and habitats and so on, parts of space stations constructed entirely in microgravity, mined from asteroids. I mean, there's a whole class of asteroids that's between the Earth and the Sun, so you may not even necessarily need to travel that far to get to some useful material. And even if you, I'm thinking metal at the moment, but like you said, even water, you know, water's heavy. Not having to bring water up from the Earth, that'd be good.
Yep.
And if you can get it to a base on the moon, to a base in orbit, then you can electrolyze that water, split it into hydrogen and oxygen, you have rocket fuel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can use that rocket fuel to go on what sounds like a long trip of months, maybe even years, to rendezvous with some of these asteroids. But the lag time of starting up a new mine on Earth is even longer. Mm-hmm. It takes a long time to find an ore deposit and then get together what it takes to build a mine and get it into production. So if you had the ability to identify which asteroids were worth going to, and then go to them, and it was only months or a couple years to get them to the point of producing, this is faster than you would do it on Earth. So
that's true.
They're like the gas stations of space.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, he was suggesting that. He was providing fuel, provide water.
Propel it and water. And water, I mean, water is great for drinking, but it's also good for growing your lunar salad.
Exactly.
It's good for...
our Martian salad.
That's right. It's also good for shielding you against radiation. As she says, you could ionize it to run an electric system. There's all kinds of things you can do.
There's also, even things like carbon. I mean, surely there's quite a lot of carbon up there. Mm-hmm. And
carbonaceous chondrites.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And carbon's pretty useful, I think. So you could build a whole range, a whole class of structures using carbon. Mm-hmm. And
And you could imagine the architecture of the future of low Earth orbit and sort of cis-lunar space being influenced by which materials are easy to process.
Yeah.
Just like we used to build cities out of whatever we knew how to make out of nature, whether it was wood or sandstone.
Yeah,
they're testing 3D printers up in the ISS right now, so you never know. You just go to the asteroid, put the 3D printer right there, and tell it to print up a spacecraft
something.
Exactly, I know.
Right. Yeah, whole inflatable habitats printed on orbit out of nickel, because that's what's easy to get on orbit. Because that's the first thing we learn how to smelt and refine on orbit.
Yeah.
The one major issue I see is, if you're going to go mine an asteroid, is the velocity, the direction that the asteroid is going in.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the issue that I... Because I have this idea in my head, which a lot of people will have from things, from culture, such as Star Trek or whatever sci-fi you happen to watch when you were younger, of pulling asteroids into a convenient spot. So I'm not entirely sure...
And NASA has this idea now.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm not entirely sure how practically possible that is, but that's what I'm thinking of. So you find an asteroid, you go there, you pull it into a convenient place around Earth, then you mine it at your leisure. Now, this might not in fact be possible. You may need to go and do things in situ and then leave before a certain time limit. So
maybe,
In terms of that, that's a kind of... If you start thinking about that in practical terms, then you can imagine, ships of miners or robots getting there and having a specific time limit by which they have to finish their business, get off with their materials before they get too far and they can't get back, and they have to wait 10,000 years for the asteroid to come.
Characterize your orbits and characterize your chemistry.
Exactly.
You can imagine some kind of future industrial region around the Lagrangian spot.
Yes, exactly.
Around our orbit.
Exactly.
There's a place up in northern Ontario right now, the so-called Ring of Fire deposits, chromium and other metals, that the government of Ontario and some industrial concerns have been trying to develop.
And it took a while to find it, and then it took a while to determine that it was rich enough in those metals to be worth going to. But now there's no road, and there's no railroad, and it's like, how do you get it? You can get in with an airplane, but just like with spaceships, you know, mass is important.
Yes.
So, and so there's been this whole process of trying to figure out how to get there. And with any ore deposit on Earth, you have this question of the practicality of getting there, and then what is the return on that based on how rich the deposit is and how hard it is to mine.
Mm-hmm.
We'll probably find a new set of parameters like that on orbit.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forster, and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts John Kissy, Parshati Patel, Raymond Francis, and Tony Martinez. Our editors were John Kissy and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can find world enough in time to join us again next week, right here on Western Worlds.